Okay, we've got Joe, W-H-R-Y-Y. Thank you, Joe. This is the beginning of the TechNet. And at the very beginning, Eric's going to give us a report of what has happened at the repeater recently. TechNet gathers every Sunday night for 4 solid hours, would you believe? Crazy people gather that long because they're curious, want to know more about wireless equipment, how it works, and how to make it work better. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. And this will be TechNet number 1722, would you believe? After 36 years, 1982 September is when it started. Yep. I think it's 36 years, 36 and a fraction years. In the very beginning, N2FDJ and I thought that we would answer people's questions in a couple of weeks and the TechNet would be through. There's always new people joining, always new kinds of ham radio are being invented. There's now something like 27 or 28 different kinds of ham radio. And by way of the digital mode, there's really quite a few more of them, you could say. Let me drop. We very loosely divide the TechNet into three sections. The first section is where people sign in because they do have a question or a comment. You need not sign in just because you're listening. After 36 years, we believe somebody is listening. And you have to remind me from time to time to make sure we let it drop long enough so that the people from the outer fringes, by way of the IRLP or Echo Link, make sure they have enough time to sign in. So the first third is approximately a third is the question and answer period. That's followed by Roy, AC2GS, and Dr. Roy gives us a science talk. And he's got quite a list of interesting subjects of what science and NASA have been doing lately. The third section is the space report by Paul WS2N. And he has memorized where every nut and bolt is on the International Space Station. I'm exaggerating only a little bit, but that's the biggest piece of hardware, almost 1 million pounds of stuff, as big as a football field, including the end zone. That's the size of the International Space Station. Quite a piece of hardware. Okay, at this time we're going to take chickens. You're going to sign in by giving me your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. Please try to remember to wait for the 4 beeps before you press the push-to-talk button. Otherwise, you might be timing out. K2I to be listening for people who have got a question or a comment.
82AMZ, Mike, yes.
Okay, Mike recognized, and Mike tonight will discuss anything except batteries. I'm not quite sure what you want to talk about. I'm having some fun with him. So we've got Joe and Mike. Anyone else to check in? Give me your call letters and name right now. One of the people who's going to be signing in, because he sent me a letter, going to be Frank, Kilo Echo 2, Kilo Bravo, who's got an interesting question, which requires quite a bit of explanation. There are people who think they're going to get completely free consulting by a written return. I'm such a slow typer that, with rare exception, I don't get a chance to answer people's questions directly. But verbally, I can talk 150 words a minute, and I can give an awful lot of information. And by the feedback, we find out whether or not the question was misinterpreted. So by way of the TechNet, I can give a significantly long explanation. Okay, we've got Joe and Mike. One last call. Anyone else that sign in? Because you do have a question or a comment for the net. Give me a call letter and name right now. K2RI, if you're listening. Okay, before we start, maybe now's the right time, Eric, for you to explain what you saw with your time domain reflectometer looking at the cable going to the antenna. And then I think you tapped into the duplexing filter receiver input to see what extraneous signals were there that could be giving the front end grief. And I think you also were checking on the amount of isolation between transmitter frequency and receiver response, which of course is that broadband signal 600 kc away, the sidebands of the transmitter. How much rejection was the duplexer giving? KE2EJ, with that technical report of what he found up there in at Glen Oaks, K2IW in the TechNet. You got it, Eric. K2IW, KJJ. Okay, so here's the story. The first thing I did was take a look at the antenna via the TDR, and I can see where the jumper is, and I can see where the antenna is. It's about 110 feet away, and you can see the closeness between the jumper cable and the antenna itself, and it actually bugs me a little bit the way I see it, because it, to me it seems to be too big of a bump. Like, maybe we don't have a really good ground connection between the jumper and the antenna, or the jumper and the feed line coming in. That's one issue. Although it looks as though it's intact, although I don't have the experience of doing this a lot, so I'm making a judgment based upon what I know and what I see. So I see a very definite reflection from either the connector or the jumper cable itself. It's just about the right length away. And then I see the antenna, which is a very short length, looks like about 3 or 4 feet, between the jumper cable and the antenna. That's one thing that's got to look, be looked at. Looking further down the line, let me let it drop first.
Jumper.
Eric, every jumper is going to give you a bit of a glitch at the first connector and the second connector of that jumper. But if that glitch is something that with the high gain mode on the TDR you can see it, that may not be significant. That glitch could probably be a nanosecond long and an instantaneous S11 of say equivalent to a 1.2 to 1, but it's very, very brief just at the input of that connector. So although it's easy to resolve on a TDR, on a steady state signal going in there, it might not represent anything more than a 1.1 standing wave ratio, if you know what I mean. That's a guess on my part. Over to you, Eric.
Now, before I took the TDR out there, I did a couple of experiments with it. With just a coil, a cable, and a terminator, and a couple of connectors. And everything being good, you see the disturbance of the connector where the transition is, but the amplitude of the reflected pulse is usually small compared to the indication that you get where the load is. So, looking at the antenna, I see the reflection from the jumper as being too big. And then to kind of confirm that, putting 50 watts into the cable, and somehow or other at the end, don't forget the cable is 100 and some odd feet long, I gain about 8 to 10 watts reflected, and that's kind of bugging me. So that may be an indication of something going on down at the far end, because, you know, whatever's reflected is going to get absorbed by the attenuation of the cable on the way back. So that's one issue. Now, what I decided to do was to look at what the receiver is seeing. Let me let it drop again. Looking at what the output of the duplexer is going into the antenna, while the transmitter is transmitting, I am getting the 600 kilohertz up from where the duplexer is tuned. For the receiver side, I'm seeing the transmitter at about minus 60. And I use a well-calibrated spectrum analyzer for that, but got a perfect 50 ohm load at its input. The duplexer that I got, supposedly, is doing about minus 100, according to Steve, who tuned it up for me. And so that's hurting me a little bit. Let's see. The other thing I discovered that now the duplexer's input has a circulator and a bandpass filter before it actually gets into the duplexer. You know, I was going to make a connection to it. I put my hand on the load, and I said, it's warm. So it turns out the circulator is putting about 10 watts into that load. Okay, so, you know, he tuned up the duplexer, I guess, with a 50-ohm source and 50-ohm termination to make the adjustments. So the fact that I'm getting 8 watts back from the antenna, looking at the antenna alone without the duplexer. All right, so we're heating up a good 10 watts, heating the load on the circulator. And so that says to me that the input impedance to the duplex is not exactly right, or the output impedance to the transmitter is a little bit off. And by the way, I made the measurement with a load on the 50 ohm load on the end of the duplexer is not to take the reflected energy from the antenna. So that's kind of where I'm at the moment.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Did you miss? You were coming through 375, even though 85 was dropped out. And the fact you're going to give Billy a call is what you were discussing. 8 watts reflected out of 100 watts going into the antenna is a calculated 1.78, 1.79 standing wave ratio. And with a perfect 50 ohm termination on the antenna port, 8 or 10 watts going into the circulator dummy load does sound a little bit high. Over to you, Eric, KQLAW.
And you came back to call Zulu with a question for Eric. 3-5 audio.
Right. So, well, with the 8 watts coming back, we're starting out with about 50 watts, so 50, not 100. Actually, the amplifier is putting out 80 watts. When we finally get through the circulator and the duplexer, while it's connected to the antenna, we're doing about 50 watts. So, between 80 and 50 is a bit of a loss, would you not say? By the way, 8 watts reflected out of 50 watts is a 2.33 standing wave ratio. That's getting to the threshold of alarm. So I guess you're saying you're going to have Billy take a look at that. So back to you, Eric.
Okay, that call Zulu with a question.
I didn't hear what that station said. All right, anyway, so that kind of leads me to believe a little bit about the jumper to start with, because the antenna really shouldn't have that much, you know, it should have a pretty good visual because the antenna is actually cut to be in the middle of the 2-meter band, so, you know, I had expected to be somewhere decent. Although, I didn't really take the time to measure the return loss of just the antenna because I started to, but with all the RF that's up there, and especially the 91.3, which is coming down the pipe really strong, but you don't see it once you get into the filters, but trying to do the return loss measurement, it just kind of makes it really difficult. I can do it, I just have to bring this stuff with me to knock that stuff out before I start. But anyway, so the end resultant problem now is that I'm getting some mixing products. The mixing products is totally digital in nature. I can tell there's a digital signal, and it actually is so wide it goes between 2.5 and 8.5 and actually goes beyond on both ends. So that's either we got a bad shield somewhere, or it's leaking in somewhere, or there's a new transmitter that may not even be on that building that is very dirty. So that's where I'm at the moment. And I actually had the service monitor and the spectrum analyzer trying to correlate between the two. I spent an hour looking all over the place and nothing.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Yeah, holding all that equipment and making those measurements is quite athletic. Bill QGZ wants to ask a question. I'll go right ahead, Bill.
WB2QGZ. So a couple things, and then we can go into detail as needed. So first, Eric, I assume using an Enrisu SiteMaster type device or using an actual TDR? That's question one. And that'll determine whether we talk about the DTF return loss and the interpretation of your jumper, which we can go into a little bit of detail if you want. And one thing I'll bring up, I noticed on three separate VHF repeaters that there was either a third order or fifth order product between Verizon's A block LTE and 700 and the 2-meter transmitter. Now, I'll admit that all of them seem to be higher in the band, up around like 147.27 to 85, 3033. But what we did to clear that up in most cases, and it worked reasonably well, is used a out of one of these Motorola, whatever sort of that first or second generation repeater is. I think it's probably an MSF 5000. They have either a 600 or 500 or 600 megahertz low pass filter that they have after the circulator. It's a long tube, male end on one side, female end on the other side, and that will suck that out sufficiently to get rid of some of that noise if you think that might be your issue. So roll around to Eric and wondering if he was using an Inrisu Sidemaster or something like that.
You've got it, Eric.
No, we're using a Sidemaster for the TDRF. And, you know, this stuff started happening about a month ago, months and week or two. But what I see coming back into me looks like it's a little bit stretchy. It's got these spikes running through it, and it's pretty broad. So, you know, it's coming right out of the receive cavities, which means that the mixing products are occurring before all this stuff. So, you know, we never used to have this issue at all.
Okay. So if you want to talk about that jump a little bit, so here's a concern when we're using an Inrisu device like that on a relatively narrow bandwidth antenna, like a VHF or UHF stick, right? So a lot of those devices are designed to work with antennas that are a couple of hundred megahertz wide. And when we try to resolve DTF on like a 300 or 400 megahertz wide sweep, the way the Fourier stuff works is it gives us some decent resolution. When we try to knock that down to 100 megahertz, we lose a lot of resolution and distance. So one of the concerns is if you sweep it really narrow, you don't have great resolution. And if you sweep it really wide, you have great resolution, but you have a distorted antenna value, if that makes sense, because there's a lot of non-resident energy back there at the antenna that's coming back to you when you sweep it really wide. Let me drop. So the thing that I do on narrowband antennas is I'll normally do a return loss, and there should be, in other words, that's going to tell me what my antenna system looks like overall, right? And then I want to find out where the issues might be. So I'll do a return loss, and there should be a mode on that Sidemaster. It's called interference rejection or something like that. And what it does is wobble the incident signal, and it tracks the reflex signal. So it takes any steady state, tries to take any steady state stuff that's there that's not you out of the picture, and it does a pretty good job of that, right? So I'll do a return loss, get an idea of where I'm at, and you have to remember on the return loss screen to add the round trip insertion loss of your cable. So if you're reading a 20 dB insertion loss, 20 dB return loss, and you have 2 dB each way of insertion loss of the cable, your return loss at the antenna is 16 dB. So then, if you have a bad value, then you DTF, and now you get an idea of where the issue is. So that's it. That's just my way of troubleshooting that. I wonder what the value in return loss of the bumps you saw of that jumper were, if you remember.
The actual value, I don't actually remember. I tried to narrow it down. I wound up having this use a spread of like 60 to 70 megahertz to make the Sidemaster even happy. I have a really good Tektronix TDR, but it's in the city. I just didn't have the opportunity to go get it. And that thing, I can actually bring it down to a megahertz wide and not deal with all the stuff to the left and right of me. But the jumper itself, was almost of the same amplitude of deflection as the antenna itself. That's why I'm suspicious. But what I'm going to have, because I don't know if you're aware of this, Bill, we had an antenna fail on us not that long ago. And Mr. Chuck had an antenna that he was going to put up here, but it was a new antenna, so they put that in. And they didn't have a jumper, and they had to go find one, and I have a feeling there's some adapters on it. So, I'm not unconvinced that there's not a problem, but I'm not convinced that it's, didn't get waterbound or anything like that. And it really became noticeable one day when it was really windy and raining. So, and then after that, we were kind of blind for a while until I went up there the other day.
Okay, so we're going to assume that the antenna has a return loss of around 14 dB. That's going to be about a 1.5. That's probably what it's like out of the box, give or take. And if your jumpers match that value, then that's probably not good. So what I'll typically look at is I'll want my connectors to be probably no worse than about a minus 28 dB in the, on the DTF, right? So a return loss at that connector about a minus 28. A lot of connectors are better. We use some, even on the large transmission lines, we use a low PIM compression connector, and those tend to be a little bit more sloppy. Maybe 25, but if it's any less than 25, or any more energy reflected than 25 dB return loss, then there's probably something going on there. So, like that. So, again, good number is about a minus 28. You should be better than minus 35 for all your cable, way better. And then whatever the antenna is, in the DTF measurement on that ANRISU, it's going to give you the actual value at each spot because you're compensating for velocity factor and return loss, which isn't compensated for in the return loss screen. But usually in VHF, I'd say I'd sweep about 100 megahertz for my DTF. For my return loss, And then when I did the DTF, same deal, 100 megahertz there, I would just know that my end value of the antenna is going to be worse than I expect it to be because I'm sweeping it. It's not reflecting energy where it's resonant, but it's reflecting energy where it's not. So I use that as a DTF, or as solely as a diagnostic tool. So that's pretty much...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
No, I got that, even though you timed out. I'm listening multiple places here. One thing that's striking me about it is that I think the jumper that they wound up with had a DIN connector on it. They had to convert from the DIN connector back to an N connector. So, mechanically, I don't actually have access to the roof, so that's why I'm going to get hold of Billy and try to arrange it to be there at the same time as he is. We can limit all of stuff. Also, I can put a Terminator up there and just check the cable out and be independent of the antenna, which I can't do at this point, so. To be continued, that's all I can say.
Yeah, I've got a question for you, Bill. Stand by for a beep. The swept frequency technique for doing a quasi-time domain reflectometry, which is what I think ANRISU is doing, at each one of the frequencies, it looks at the amplitude of the reflected signal and the phase angle and puts all of that great big matrix of data at each one of the stopped frequencies into a great big matrix, does a Fourier transform on it, and figures out what the TDR is. However, the antenna itself is a narrowband device, and of course it's a megacycle or two of frequency region. It's giving an additional phase shift of reflection going on internal to the antenna. Therefore, the Fourier transform technique for getting a quasi-TDR, I think, can get contaminated. Is that approximately true, Bill? WB2QGZ, K2IW?
Yep, absolutely. But what I have found in banging my head against these, again, relatively narrow antennas in the past, right? When we do this stuff on a cell site, I'm sweeping typically 1700 to 2200 megahertz, right? So I got plenty of resolution in there, and the antenna is resonant throughout that entire space. So it's real easy to troubleshoot that antenna. When I do a narrow antenna, again, that's why I look at the return loss, right? So we do a return loss sweep. I get an idea of how much cable I have, so I know how much resistive cable loss to take out of that return loss value, and that's what I base the performance of the return loss, or the ultimate return loss, or VSWR of the antenna, I base on that return loss sweep. When I'm trying to troubleshoot an issue, see how long the line is, stuff like that, I'll use the DGF with those same settings. I understand that my antenna value is going to be way off, but what I found is when I've located a bad jumper up top, or a bad jumper on the bottom, or a lightning protection on the bottom, or a bad ground kit that's damaged a cable 100 feet in, that it's been relatively correct. Generally, the bad value, let me let it drop. Okay, the large bad value, or the large reflection, if you want to call it that, on a DTF at the end of the line, generally things past a big reflection, further than the big reflection, will be really distorted, right? Things prior to it tend to reflect reality a little bit more, if that makes sense. In other words, if I have a 12-foot jumper at the bottom and a transmission line connector, and it's bad at the transmission line connector, I'll still see things after that transmission line connector, but they won't be real. Once I fix that transmission line connector, everything beyond it starts to look normal. So normally we'll fix the biggest blob, closest blob first, if that makes sense.
That's completely. And by the way, as far as like the cable that goes up to the roof, it's unlabeled, so you know it's 3/4 inch. So I chose like LBF5 for my velocity factor, and I know it's pretty much just a guess, but you know, you can see the reflection. The first reflection is the one that irked me.
Let me see if I got it. Okay, it's safe to assume if that's a foam dielectric, which it probably is. Loss is, I want to say it's going to be something like 0.013 dB per foot, give or take, and that's consistent with LDF5, and your velocity factor is not that big a deal. All of those foam cables are somewhere between 0.88 and 0.92, so you'll be in a pretty good space for that. And honestly, when you sweep a long cable with 2 half-inch jumpers on the end, and you have, you know, 20 feet a half-inch, and you know, whatever the length of your transmission line is, there's 10-12 feet of slop in there, you know, no matter what. But the important thing is you can down where it is, right? Is it on the bottom where I can get at it? Is it up top where I got to get a crew? And a lot of times you can say, yeah, it's the jumper or it's the antenna, right?
As part of what you were describing, Bill, I call it the TDR look-through characteristic. If somewhere in the middle of the cable I've got a perturbation, bad connector, pinched cable, or whatever, up to that point, and at that point itself, you'll get pretty good data. The TDR will look through a bad point and give you some kind of an indication downrange, and you can read ranges, you know, how many feet downrange is the antenna, but the stuff beyond the first bump, like you said, gets heavily distorted, either if it's a pure real time domain or it's the swept frequency type time domain. Either one of them will give you a look-through distortion, as I see it. Let's see if Eric has some more he wants to say on all of the above. KE2BJ, K2RIW in the group.
I got to say this. I'm not a regular two-way guy. I mean, you know, I'm spoiled rotten that most of my feed line is 3-inch or 6-inch hard line, and it's a different game. Just to show you what kind of a different game it is, I've actually got to replace all my hardline when I switch over to channel 32 because the lengths are wrong on channel 21 to go to channel 32. So I'm used to seeing it that way, and totally most of my measurements are done in the time domain, not in the frequency domain. So when everything's right, when you see the end, you see everything nice past the end.
And when things are wrong, it stares you right in the face, and what's beyond looks like something you've never seen before. So, my experience is in a different world, so I'm kind of dragging my feet here.
You're saying that because you change frequency, the length of the transmission line has to be tuned? Run that by again, Eric.
When you're talking about hardline, you're talking about sections. There's a, you're talking about drawn copper. That's 3 inches. It's actually 3 1/8 or 6 1/8 inch in diameter with bullets that connect the pieces together with flanges that you bolt together with big bolts. So it's not like one continuous piece of cable that's from one end to the other. Each one of these segments are of a specified length. And in theory, you either line them up quarter wave or eighth wave where you butt them up against each other.
Are you doing this for Vislock correction, or has the antenna got more than one feed point and those lengths have to be properly adjusted? Over to you, Eric.
Cut all the antennas on you. Say that again, Dick.
You've got specific lengths between your connectors, your bullets, whatever. Is that for attempted standing wave ratio cancellation, or does the antenna have more than one feed point, and you got to make sure that those lengths are correct? Over to you, Eric.
If you happen to have an antenna like I have on the side mount, where it's actually two antennas put together, then you have to take that into consideration. Usually there's some tuning screws right at that feed point, but what we're really talking about is just being able to maintain a visual that's been unbelievably ridiculous low numbers.
Now, for you to get a very low visual with a tuned length of cable means you get a low visual for a steady state signal. But for a broadband signal or an impulse signal, the individual bumps are still there, in my opinion, Eric. Go ahead.
They are. We're looking over a 6 megahertz bandwidth, so. When we make the measurements, it'll be at the low frequency, the mid frequency, and the high frequency. But we're talking about numbers that, like this particular antenna and its feed line, and at its center frequency, which would be 515, the numbers we're talking about are like 1 to 1.035, I think 1 to 1.0357. So you wind up with numbers like that.
I think you're telling me you're looking for 40 or 50 dB reflection coefficient?
At minimum. Consider now, in the analog world, we didn't care that much, but we cared. In the digital world, we care so much, it's unbelievable, because we can make our own inter-symbol distortion before it even gets out to the antenna.
So the individual reflections from the individual bumps in the system, you want them to be 40 or 50 dB down because the inter-symbol distortion is that sensitive, is what I think you're saying. An inter-symbol distortion, 40 dB down, can make a typical receiver have trouble.
It equalizes in the receivers, and we had this discussion once about pre-ghost. It's really critical. I mean, we're talking symbols that are a nanosecond. And, in the analog world, it would show up as ghost, but it takes a lot before you actually start seeing a ghost because you're dealing with the mid-frequency response in the analog, because really it's amplitude modulation. Actually, the digital signals that we're using right now is also amplitude modulation, so we just don't think of it that way. The concept is to keep those individual bumps down that, down 40 dB, at least minimum on the way up. And, you have many sections going up the tower, so that's the point of them being the precise length.
Before you visited the site last time, we were getting bursts of noise that we're not getting now, so you've made some kind of an improvement, Eric. What did you change?
Oh, while I was up there, I did a little tweaking of the receiver. The scrub settings were a little bit too loose. relying totally on the PL to manage everything, so we're getting additional bursts of noise because of that. And I also turned on the reverse burst for the tone, which helped, but when you look at the thing on the spectrum analyzer, we have a weak signal. It gets blasted.
So your spectrum analyzer on the receiver port of the duplexing filter, I think you're saying there's a lot of things there that you wish were not there?
Well, whenever that offending signal is not there, it's beautiful.
And the offending signal, what kind of duty factor did you see? Is it on 10% of the time?
No, it's rather intermittent. And, you know, I was just thinking about what Bill just said, that there's the 6 and 7 has 100 megahertz stuff, which is relatively new in some areas. You know, they're not transmitting all the time. It's just that when there's activity. But during the day, it happens a lot. Like tonight, it doesn't happen very often.
Yeah, we're doing pretty well tonight so far, as far as intermods are concerned. Is there some additional information you want to give us, Bill? WB2QGZ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yep, had to scurry back to the big radio. With regard to that A-block LTE, it's up all the time. It is a whole bunch of individual subcarriers, and there is somewhere between, if I had to pick a number, I'd say a 12 dB delta between an empty channel and a full channel, so that's a lot of power. But it's always there, so it's never not there. So based on Eric's description, I'm tending to lean away from that. WB2QGZ.
You've got it, Eric.
All right, well, I'm going to go the physical route first and inspect everything and hopefully sweep the thing while there's no antenna connected to it and see if everything's kosher, at least at that point, and then we'll go from there.
Eric, when you're transmitting right now, I'm hearing you beautiful out of 8.5. Oh, on my signal also. The signal on 3.75 has got a continuous tone in there. Have you heard that, Eric? Go ahead.
It's like the link, it's the link audio.
Yeah, actually, that Sam up in Connecticut just alerted me to it a little earlier. I actually haven't heard it myself, and, from what I'm told, it's probably beyond my range of hearing.
It sounds like about an 800 hertz tone. Were you telling us what it is, Bill? Go ahead.
Blue MY2H. I think it's coming in on the link because, you know, pure carrier is okay, but when you guys are on and the link is coming through, there's that buzz on it. And, I don't know how I'm coming in on it now. I may sound clear on the output because I'm not coming through the link, but I think it's the link.
Yes. When I listen to you on 3.75, you're clean. When I listen to you on 8.5, I'm hearing that crazy tone. So that extra tone, you're saying it's the link. So in other words, there's a CW carrier on the link frequency. Is that what you think it is, NY2H?
Well, it's link related. Eric would know more, but there's another repeater doing the link function, I think on UHF, and it seems to be now going in both directions as you're pointing out. So,
how can the link give us the same amount of tone in both directions? That's a little bit mysterious. Back to you, Lou.
Well, one of the two repeaters, one in Glen Oaks and one in Selden, not the main repeaters, but the link repeaters. Probably is involved. I don't know.
I just tuned to the link frequency and I can't hear it here. I gotta go out into the car. The way I've got this thing running, I'm not gonna be able to hear it, and I've gotta hear it from somewhere else.
Your hearing cuts off at roughly what frequency, Eric? Would you hear an 800 hertz tone?
I currently am. I can't hear the link frequency. I've got too much attenuation there. It's actually a monolocking antenna. Don't forget the remote receiver is sitting right next to me, so I don't need, I'm only running like 100 milliwatts.
82AMZ.
WHCDL Mobile.
82AMZ, Nick, I gotta go. I gotta be at the job at 5 a.m.
Okay, Mike, sorry about that. Andy, go ahead.
Let me just give my little info. There's two different kinds of lithium batteries. The AA is lithium iron sulfide, and the 9-volt version is lithium magnesium dioxide. The AA is about 300 milliamp hours, the 9-volt is about 750 milliamp hours, so that should give you a clue.
Thanks, Eric. I appreciate it. We'll pick this up next week, but thank you, Gutch. I got to go to bed, guys. Good night. Thank you.
And Eric, those lithium batteries have got a real good shelf life. In other words, very low internal drain.
Well, the shelf life is about 20 years, according to the manufacturer. Oh, no, I'm sorry, 10 years.
I noticed an awful lot of the AA's I buy these days from the Golden Top. I can't think of the brand name. They now say they're good for 10 years right on the package. Is that the kind of batteries we're talking about?
Yes, it is. And I gave them a little bit of misinformation previously, saying that the AA is 1.35, but because it's lithium iron disulfide, it's close to 1.5. But they say that's a nominal voltage, but if you look at the chart, it's a little bit lower.
Yeah, when I take those 10-year batteries and put my digital voltmeter on them, if they're really fresh, I measure 1.6 volts, Eric.
XM?
I'm always going by the manufacturer spec here.
Okay, XM, go ahead.
B2RIW in the group, WP2, call X-ray Mike, this is Rich. Eric, are those AA batteries, you say they are lithium iron, not lithium ion. Is the lithium iron, all right, I'm messing it all up. Are those batteries rechargeable? WP2GXM.
Lithium ion, I-O-N, India Ocean, Nancy. Those are rechargeable with a charge controller. The lithium iron disulfide, which is FeS2, you know, chemistry, those are not rechargeable, and that's what we're talking about.
You are WP2GXM out.
So the ones we're now talking about that are good for 10 years, how long ago were they introduced as an easily obtained product? In other words, I've only noticed for about a year or so I see these 10-year labels when I buy a group of AA's. Over to you, Eric. Okay, maybe we'll get that information a little bit later. Let's see, we got Joe, the B2RYY. Haven't heard from you in some time, so go right ahead, Joe, with your question or comment. D2RYW and the Tech Man.
Well, you'll have to stay up with it for another time. I can't stay up too much longer. Have a good one, the B2RYY.
You're on the, you're number one on the runway right now, so why don't you give us a little bit of the information? Go ahead.
Because it's actually a comment. It's about a subject you talked about last week. Another time.
Okay, the subject, you're going to keep it a secret. Not even going to tell us the name of the subject. And Mike signed. So right now we've got nobody on the list of anybody with questions or comments. Anybody want to sign in because they do have a question or a comment? Give me your call letters and your name right now.
I think I want to just mention something, WHCDL Mobile.
Go ahead, Andy.
Yeah, Mr. Eric, I did hear what sounded like a heterodyne on the link frequency when Lou NY2H was transmitting. And it sounds like it also has TL or DTL on it, just by listening to what it sounds like, just by ear. Just wanted to mention that. Back to you.
All right, Andy, I'll look into it. This is the first I'm hearing about it.
Yeah, any of us that go into the 2.5 input, we come out of 8.5 nice and clean, and 9.75 has got this buzz. anybody going in on 975 comes out 975 clean, but it's got the buzz on 85. And the sound of the buzz in either of those directions sounds identical in amplitude and beating PL tone, so to speak. So, a bit unusual. Let's see if we have anyone else that wants to sign in, because they do have a question or a comment for the TechNet. Give me a call, let us name right now. K2RIW listening. Okay, there being none, we'll go over to the science talk a little bit earlier. And you've got an interesting list there of subjects that you've told me about. And I think you're not going to get a chance to go through very many of those from my point of view, Roy. AC2GS and the science talk, K2RIW and the TechNet.
Thank you, Dick. I hope that I only touch on a few, because that means that people are participating, and that's a good thing. How's my signal?
Signal is beautiful. And anybody listening to Roy, make sure that if you've got a comment, you give us a comment. Roy likes a lot of participation. He likes precipitation also. Go ahead, Roy.
Yes, I do, as long as I have an umbrella available. There's a few things that I want to mention. I always mention them, and people get them wrong, unfortunately. If you want to contact me for either a topic, a question, a disputation, what have you, the email address that you can reach me at is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. Everything that I talk about and some interesting YouTubes and images that I've come across, you will be able to find at the top of a web page. You just point your browser to roy.ac2gs.com, and it'll come up. And as always, actual chat room that right now just has me in it, but occasionally people wander in and they make comments, and I respond to them if I'm not talking on the radio simultaneously. So keep that all in mind, and on with the show.
Is there a simple way you can tell somebody how to get to the chat room, Roy?
Well, I think the easiest is just to go to a browser and type the word chat, C-H-A-T, dot, AC2GS, dot, C-O-M. That strikes me as the easiest. You could also go to limark.org and find it on the page, but I think it's easier to just type the word chat and my call sign and the always present dot, C-O-M.
Very good. Thank you, Roy.
Okay, so as I said, I posted a couple of interesting YouTubes on my page, roy.ac2gs, and one of them, I'm sure a lot of you guys really know about it, but for the people who don't know about it or aren't quite sure, I'm sure everyone has talked to each other and told everyone about the great old days of Radio Row on Canal Street, and how all these used and old World War II vintage pieces of electronic equipment were discounted and thrown in boxes, and you could just rummage through and get all kinds of great things. Recently, I've been looking at YouTubes of a district in Tokyo called Akihabara. They call it the Electronic District, and it's kind of like the Canal Street Radio Row on steroids. There are shops at the shops after shops. There's stores that have blaring HF signs, and you can actually see Yaesu transceivers in the window. There are stores where they just have one type of component. They have transformers, all shapes, all size, all power ratings. There was apparently a store that only sold chassis, made out of any material you wanted for any dimension that you wanted. So it's a fascinating YouTube. If I find a better one, I will post that as well. But take a look at it, because it's the envy of the world. I mean, I'm sure that if you see this place, you wish that it was taking place down in Canal Street this very moment.
It's a long commute, right? Not sure my metro card will cover it.
Well, there's a gentleman who's apparently connected to Limark, not tonight, but he comes on regularly from Tokyo, Japan, and he makes contacts using Echolink, and maybe if you talk nice to him, he'll send you something from Akihabara.
Worth a shot.
What can he do? Go to you, but it's just to look at the images just kind of had my jaw drop because I can't imagine a store that only sells chassis. I mean, you know, where would we put one of those? I mean, it would be great to have one, but I don't know if you could maybe to make a profit just selling boxes of for electronic equipment. But it's a fascinating subject. Please look at the link, look at the images, and if you find a better one on that electronic district, let me know, and I'll post that as well. Okay, on to another subject. There's been some more information gleaned regarding our recent interstellar visitor, Oumuamua, specifically observations performed by researchers using the Spitzer Space Telescope and published in the Astronomical Journal have determined that prior observations likely established too generous an upper boundary on how large it could be. Apparently, the Spitzer Space Telescope recently failed to see the object in the infrared spectrum over the course of a two-month survey. Now, based upon various models of what exactly Oumuamua is made out of and how reflective it is, that seems to set the new upper boundary of the object to 1,440 feet, and it might actually be as small as 320 feet. Now, this could be explained by solar radiation warming frozen gases on its surface and venting them as it tumbles through the void, a process called outgassing, and that could act as the de facto propulsion mechanism that everyone was unsure of. This latest finding, establishing a lower upper boundary on its size, makes that explanation much more likely because, as NASA noted, it relies on Oumuamua being a relatively smaller than typical solar system comet. The study also found that the object may be up to 10 times more reflective than the comets that reside in our solar system. NASA wrote because outgassing may have swept accumulated filth off of it and revealed underlying ice and snow. Let me drop for a second. So according to NASA, this is probably the last time you're going to hear me talk about Oumuamua because the object is no longer visible. There's no real study that we can do with it anymore. All the future bits of information will be pretty much based upon people analyzing the data that they already have. So that's it with Oumuamua. Unfortunately, it looks like we do not have an alien inside there waving hello to us. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
Questions or comments? Okay, I heard the word comment. Because that object is coming into our solar system from another solar system, it therefore has an extremely high velocity. Its trajectory, you can tell by it's a great big curved path into our solar system, around our sun, and then back out again. As such, I can't believe that any outgassing or propulsion on board can have anywhere near enough effect on that. I mean, we're talking about, numbers like 160,000 miles an hour to roar into our solar system from another solar system. Back to you, Roy, KQIW.
I don't think that they're proposing outgassing as the means of its propulsion. A lot of it was it was accelerated outside of our solar system by probably gravitational forces, and it did a whip around the sun, which was also gravitational forces. The thing that confused them was that when it whipped around and started to go out, it should have slowed down a little bit more than it did due to the gravitational pull of the sun. So they were trying to figure out why the heck the acceleration was slightly off the calculation. And pretty much the best guess these days is not a solar sail like that guy in Harvard or little green men with an interstellar propulsion system, but simply outgassing that caused that ever so slight change in acceleration. So it's not the magnitude acceleration that you think that the object has. It's just that little strange, quirky acceleration at one point that made people think there were little green men there.
Understand. Who's the person who wanted to make a comment?
Hey, how you doing? Yeah, KD2GPS. Yeah, the trajectory alone, the way that it turned, and even when it was far off, they said it seemed to accelerate. And why wouldn't it kept going? That's what I don't get. So I think it's something. So that's just my comment, and thanks for hearing it.
Well, you know, opinions are free. You can have your opinion. Incredible theories kind of call for incredible proofs, as far as I'm concerned. So if you're going to theorize alien spaceships and such, you need to have a lot of proof. It's incredibly more likely that we've miscalculated and made it bigger than it really was, and less reflective than it really is, and that skews the results a lot. So I'm more likely in agreement with the present researchers and such rather than the guy in Harvard who had a little bit too much of something or other when he came up with the solar sails. But again, you're free to have any opinion that you want. God bless you. Thank you very much. And now on to the next story. And it reprises last week. Last week had a lot of interesting topics. Unfortunately, they have more news to report this week, so I hope people kind of enjoy it. If you were listening last week, I was talking about the General Conference on Weight and Measures and the voting on the standardization of the kilogram mass to a Planck's constant. I offered a short story on how Max Planck came up with that circuitous route that he took to come up with the Planck's constant, and he bagged the Nobel Prize for it. And just this week, one of my favorite YouTube video producers made a real shiny new video just about Max Planck, black body radiation, and Planck's constant. So once again, it's posted on roy.ac2gs.com. Take a look at it. It's a great little 12-minute presentation with lots of pretty pictures to illustrate some of the concepts. I mean, even the nerdish cartoon XKCD had a cartoon panel on the subject of this conference just this week. And that, too, is on my website. Let me drop for a second, and then I'll continue. Okay, and by the way, it even made it to the New York Times, and you can't go wrong with the New York Times. Anyway, last topic for conversation was also incidentally the subject of this week's Veritasium episode on YouTube, which I will also post a link to. Same place, roy.ac2gs.com. So enjoy it. Veritasium, Dick loves it. I love it. It's a well-done YouTube. So please take a look at it. Speaking about last week's discussion and the General Conference on Weights and Measures that wrapped up just a few days ago, they have now made it official. The mass we know and love as the kilogram is no longer defined by an artifact locked away in Paris, France. It will now be defined by the Planck constant. Same conference has also revised the definitions for the ampere in terms of the elemental charge E, the Kelvin in terms of the Boltzmann constant, which was also discovered by good old Max Planck, and the Joule in terms of Avogadro's constant. For over 70 years, the definition here has been that constant current, which if maintained in two straight parallel conductors of infinite length of a negligible circular cross-section and placed 1 meter apart in a vacuum, it would produce between these conductors a force equal to 2 × 10⁻⁷ newton per meter of length. From now on, the amount of electric charge in motion per unit time, that is the electric current, but the quantity of electric charge by itself, whether in motion or not, is now going to be expressed by another SI unit, the coulomb. 1 coulomb will be equal to about 6.241 × 10⁻¹⁸ electric charges, or exactly the reciprocal of the exactly defined value of E. 1 ampere is a current in which 1 coulomb of charge travels across a given point in 1 second. So let it be written, so let it...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
So is the kilogram now exact? Is the ohm and the volt now exact? Is anything approximate anymore, Roy?